Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show with Tyler Sheff on buying multifamily apartment buildings with no money down. Dan Breslin here, your REI Diamond Show host. Today, Tyler and I discuss buying multifamily apartments in the 4 to 20 unit range using none of his own money to do so. He does this in his own backyard, being Tampa Bay area in Florida, and he also does this in the Memphis, Tennessee area. So we're going to cover some important details to consider when you might be choosing to invest outside of the home market where you live and how to avoid some pitfalls in doing so. Tyler is also the host of Cashflow Guys podcast with more than 80 episodes running a span of about 2 years, including the One Thing co-author Jay Papasan. So grab a pen and pad, or if you are in the gym or driving right now as you listen, just sit back, pay attention, and enjoy the episode because we are going to drop a few solid jewels of wisdom on this episode. Let's get going. And welcome to the show, Mr. Tyler Sheff.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So for the REI Diamond Show listeners who do not already know who you are or may not be there in the Florida market where you're operating and know your name, do you want to kind of talk about what led you into real estate and kind of how your business developed a bit and then like what your business looks like and is comprised of today, Tyler?
Well, I basically started in real estate. I grew up in real estate. My mom was a real estate broker for many, many years, and I got into it that way, but realized that, you know, putting on that gold coat and being that realtor out in the golf course wasn't really my thing. I need a little bit more adventure in my life in my 20s, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that I could get rich flipping houses. Can you believe that?
I can understand that.
Yeah. I thought I was that guy that was going to do it up just like they did on TV, even though back then, this is going back to like year 2000, they didn't have those TV shows back then, Dan. So I was bound and determined that I was going to make a gajillion dollars flipping houses, which I got to say, we did well. A couple pitfalls, you know, a few craters along the way, so to speak, that we fell in, lost some money, got some bumps and bruises, but we recovered. And then what I discovered, though, is that when I got good at flipping houses, the IRS got really good at billing me. So I needed to kind of figure out a better way to do things. I sold my inventory of what I had flipping before that market crash, about 2 years prior to the market crash. I wasn't real responsible back then as far as keeping good records, and I thought I was the smartest guy in the room, so I would do my own taxes and made some mistakes, man. And got the bill from the IRS. Left real estate before the crash. Went to work for the federal government at sea and got a really good job making six figures a year working for the National Weather Service basically on a ship. Here's the problem though, Dan. They were taxing me again. You know, I tried to tell them, I told them I'm an only child and I don't think I should have to pay taxes and I'm incredibly charming. So can't you just give me a break? They wouldn't go for it and they insisted on taxing me anyway. So now I'm back to how do I legally avoid my taxes? And the one resounding solution that kept coming back, no matter how hard I worked to Google to search for the answer, was buy property and just don't sell them. Just hang on to them. It's that simple. And that's what got me back into real estate again. And ever since then, I've been buying multifamily properties exclusively. And we buy them, we shine them up real nice and pretty, and then we hang on to them for the long term. We've gotten completely out of the flip game altogether.
Nice. So today, I assume you're not working for the National Weather Service on a ship anymore, right?
No, in 2014, I walked down the gangway and never came back. I decided that we needed to escape the rat race because I did the cursory refresh, Dad, Poor Dad, It Changes Your Life, all that, and learned the difference between being in the rat race and being out. So the very first thing we did is we reduced our expenses because although I was making six figures a year, we were definitely living the six-figure-a-year lifestyle. So we made some changes to the way we do things, paid off our debt, and then got into real estate. I learned how to leverage other people's resources along with my own, which was kind of a game changer for us because, as you well know, the bank's only going to let you borrow so much money. And I was trying to build my portfolio like one little duplex at a time, realizing that wasn't going to get me anywhere. I had to kind of grow faster. So I learned how to raise capital, but I was doing it differently, Dan. I was focused on teaching people, so using real estate education, to teach people how to invest in real estate. Because what I found is that the majority of people that I teach, they wind up realizing how much work it is and they want no part of it. But they still want to invest. So they wind up investing with me. That spawned the rest of our business. That's where Cashflow Guys came from. You know, it's a way to I tell people it doesn't cost, it should not cost $50,000 to learn how to buy a $50,000 house, really, because you could very easily spend well into the six figures learning how to buy a house when you really don't have to learn how to buy a house. You just have to learn how to analyze a spreadsheet and pick the right people for your team. So we branched out into education for that perspective.
So you're doing multifamily, Tyler. What size of a multifamily? Are we talking about duplex, triplex, quads, or are we talking, you know, 15, 20 unit or something even larger than that that you're currently specializing in?
Primarily, our holdings start at, as far as per property, we like our sweet spot is between 4 and 20 doors per property. And the reason why we choose those is we find that we have the least amount of competition. You know, you get larger than that. Now I'm competing against the big boys, the hedge funds and whatnot. The mom and pop shops, they generally think that for whatever reason, four, five, six, ten units is difficult for them. There's an extra layer of complexity. I'm okay with them believing that. I don't want to argue with them on that. And who am I to judge? So that leaves, we don't have a lot of competition in that space because of it.
Interesting perspective there. Yeah, I know that we had Dave Lindahl on the show, and he's a big educator in the multifamily space. I don't remember his exact number, but I know that most of the people who've gone through that are looking for things of 100, 200 units and definitely staying away from the 4 to 20. So maybe that's a management issue too. I know that one of the things Dave had mentioned was, oh yeah, these are, you know, a little more economy scale with a large number. Can you talk about how you're currently managing obviously a handful or more of these 4 to 20 door multifamily properties?
Well, for us, we invest in two markets. So when we go into a market, one of the first things we do is we realize that in the management piece especially, we're going to have to kiss a lot of frogs. And, you know, I found it easier. I found better management that are focused more on the smaller assets than I have. I've been involved in syndicates and things like that where I've served different roles in syndications. And a lot of these big management companies, the important details are left to the minimum wage workers. And you find out that although they're a big company as far as management goes and they're willing to manage big assets, the quality is not there. I mean, maybe this from a boardroom perspective or from the view on a spreadsheet, but it boils down to we've had difficulty finding good practical management for the larger assets, which is another reason why we stay more towards the smaller stuff. And, you know, a lot of people say, and I know Dave even teaches this, is that to stay away from the small stuff for management, it's difficult to scale, but I would to some degree disagree. Is it more effort? It is. However, I have a lot of friends that focus on larger assets right now, and they're kind of twiddling their thumbs, waiting for an opportunity. Meanwhile, we're able to navigate the marketplace and still bring on new properties because we're shopping and we're fishing in a pond where other people are not fishing. So that helps us.
What markets are you in currently?
Currently, our focus is in Tampa Bay area, Tampa, Florida, and then we also focus in Memphis, Tennessee. We've shifted more of our focus towards the Florida market. Recently, they had some storms up in Tennessee. A lot of properties got some damage. There was a lot of power outages, things like that. But we've found that Memphis is climbing and climbing and climbing, and it's not the haven that I feel it used to be. It's still good for good, solid cash flow, but a lot of the investors that we're working with now are looking for more of value-add opportunities, and it's been a little easier to find better value-add or sleeper properties, so to speak, here in Florida than we'd be able to find in Tennessee because, again, there's just a lot of pressure, a lot of out-of-state buying pressure focused on Memphis.
Yeah, it's one of the big names that keeps coming up on our show here and on a lot of other podcasts, you know, in the real estate investment space. You're hearing Memphis, Tennessee's hot, Memphis, Tennessee this, Kent Clothier in Memphis, Tennessee, and you know, I don't have any experience buying, selling, or even checking any comps or looking into any deals there, but just strictly based on its reputation across the investment community, it sounds like a really hot area. I'm personally buying and selling single family houses mostly. We get the occasional small multi duplex, triplex deal that comes through in the Tampa Bay, Florida area. So we're in a little bit of a different space, but I'm also in single family. I'm in Chicago, I'm in Philadelphia, I'm in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, and Tampa Bay, Florida is the fifth market I operate in. And so I have a different perspective on each one of those markets. And Tampa Bay is, you know, red hot, rampantly out of reach pricing like the way it was in 2006, 2007 when I first got into business. You know, Tampa Bay, the whole state of Florida just went completely through the roof. And my experience, and it's limited only to certain markets where I'm actually doing the deals, is that we haven't seen that same run up. We saw some recovery there, but it was definitely not, you know, record setting heat like I imagine at Memphis, Tennessee, or like I know that Atlanta, Georgia is currently experiencing as a result of people moving there. Is that also your perspective? Could you kind of give me a little bit of insight on the differences of the two markets and maybe like how you went about choosing those markets in the first place, Tyler?
Well, Tampa, for one, we chose it because we live here, you know, so I've spent most of my life in the Tampa Bay market. And, you know, Tampa has good infrastructure. They're investing money into the area, so there's that. That's a big plus. Jobs have always been plentiful, and that's only been increasing recently in the last couple of years, which I'm sure you realize as well. I find that we took a good, like you're right, in 08, we took just an incredible bath in this market. Fortunately, I was able to skip that, but I did witness it just the same. And what we found is that, you know, well, there's a lot of factors, but primarily I think that I don't think that anybody's really learned anything in this market. We're almost back there in some areas. For example, if you look in the Newport Richey, Pasco area, northern Pinellas County, you're still seeing ridiculous values, and you're seeing a lot of the single family stuff down in St. Petersburg and certain pockets of Tampa that have grown exponentially. There's a shortage of inventory right now. So that in itself is driving up the market here. You're right, though. I don't think it's as bad as we experienced in 2006, 2007, 2008, because the lending isn't matching it. In other words, it's not as easy to get money now as it was then. So I think obviously that added fuel to the fire. But Memphis, on the other hand, you know, the word's gone out and a lot of people have spent a lot of money marketing to the outside, out of state, out of area investor, the turnkey opportunities. And, you know, it's a low barrier of entry, which is another big attraction. That was our initial attraction to Memphis, was low barrier of entry. At the time, we were just getting started in the multifamily space. We were looking to not have to risk a lot. We learned that that wasn't necessarily, we could have rethought that a little better, to be honest with you, because we did learn some valuable lessons up in Tennessee. We had bought some properties initially that had some very, very bad management, and lessons learned. But you know what they say? You know, I call it I've learned from John Schaub, one of our local guys, they calls it a seminar. You know, you can go to pay for a weekend seminar and sit in a seminar. You can just make a mistake in real estate, and it basically costs you about the same. So we've made some of those mistakes. I should say a lot of those mistakes. We've learned our lessons, and now we've realized, you know, what our investor identity is, number one. And we do well because the management team that we have in Memphis does very, very well for us in the lower income properties. We've got a niche product. We focus on veterans. There's a big number, but a big part of our tenant base are veterans and older folks. So we're able to, we don't have the vacancy loss that a lot of people in Memphis experience. Do we have vacancy loss? Yes, we do, but not to the same degree that most people do. I've heard horror stories, and I've heard buildings where it's like 50% is average. I'm thinking to myself, what?
Oh, my God.
I can't imagine why you would even bother owning that. I think I would burn it to the ground before I did. I kept it at that high of a vacancy rate. So we're doing pretty well overall.
Is it Memphis, Tennessee, like an overbuilt market to have 50% vacancies? Are they building too many units, or have they over the years?
I believe they have. There's a lot of property available on the ground. There's a lot of vacancy, and there's a lot of people doing a very bad job of maintaining assets. So there's a lot of depressed inventory. You know, there's a lot of deferred maintenance on a majority of it. You know, you've got one extreme to the other, and there's nothing down the middle. You know, you've got Germantown, where you've got the high-end A-class stuff. But in inner city Memphis, it goes all the way to D class. There is no C. And you can go from one street to the next and go from B to D in, you know, B class property to B like boy to D class in a matter of two blocks, which is unlike anywhere else I've seen in America, that's for sure.
So I'd like to, if we could, Tyler, I want to explore a couple of the things you said a little bit in depth. You mentioned that you guys looked at the Memphis, Tennessee area's low barrier to entry, and you thought you weren't risking much. Could you kind of maybe take us through the thinking that you and your team had on the way in and why you thought it was like kind of a low risk opportunity or proposition for you guys?
Well, you know, the great people of Memphis make it really easy to be accepted to the community. I'm not going to call it predatory. I don't believe it's predatory, but they cater to the out-of-town investor. So they make it very easy, very, very attractive by their marketing efforts, by getting on the phone with them. They're very helpful folks because they realize the impact that the out-of-state investors have. I believe they all the services realize that, so they cater to us. So initially, it almost seemed a little too good to be true, However, when you dive in, you realize real quick that Memphis is a small town. There's a good old boy program there. And if you're not connected with the right people, you could have some difficulty, in which we experienced early on. We picked the wrong management teams. I won't mention their names, but we picked the wrong management teams that had been doing business a certain way for a long time that was not only dishonest, but I would almost go so far as to say illegal. The things that they were doing, the way they treat the tenants were not like people. They treated them more like cattle, which was interesting, to say the least. So we had to make some rather aggressive changes, and I don't think that they were quite prepared for us to do that. In Florida, we respond a little more. As I'm sure you know from the Tampa Bay market, you don't see that as much because we're more of a transient state here in Florida, where roots in Tennessee are dug deep. Another big thing we learned, as far as you mentioned the team, I didn't have much of a team up there when we started. We had to build it remotely, which had its challenges. Now, I was fortunate. I did find some good boots on the ground up there, and I was able to leverage their resources to meet other people. And I spent a lot of time on the phone talking to people, building relationships, got on a plane, fly up there, shake hands, things like that to try to get the lay of the land, to try to figure things out. But I'll admit it was a big challenge, definitely a big challenge.
Okay, so you're in Memphis, Tennessee. This is all happening in a period since 2014, right, Tyler?
That's correct.
And you're no longer buying new assets in Memphis? Is it kind of like a pullback and maybe even you're going to sell the stuff you have there?
We're looking. I don't think we're going to sell at this point because everything is up and running and we've got everything rehabbed and it's starting to perform now. We our performance was a little longer than what we thought it was originally going to be. We were not as forgiving as we should have been when we were doing our initial research. So it took us a little longer to get stuff performing. And, you know, it is what it is. We will still consider assets in Memphis, but our main focus right now is the Tampa Bay market.
Let's take a dive down through an example of a deal. Let's just take, I don't know, a recent Florida 18-door apartment complex or building, rather, that you find. It doesn't have to be something that's exactly the numbers that you went through, but maybe you could just give us an idea. Hey, the price is $1 million. We raised this amount. We give the equity this amount. Just kind of like give us some details of how that would be structured to purchase a deal like this.
Well, we just did one recently. The most recent one I can think of is a little fourplex that we did, and it was an off-market opportunity. And it's kind of funny how it came about. It was a kid that wanted me to coach him, and I didn't think he was really coachable, to be perfectly honest with you. So I turned him down for the opportunity. I'm not the kind of guy that's just going to take your money and not see it through to you to perform. So I turned him down, and he said, parting call, he says, what can I do? What's the one thing I can do? I had just done the episode with Jay Papasan with the one thing, and he used it against me. He says, what was the one thing I could do to get going? And I said, well, fish in a pond where nobody else is fishing. Send direct mail to multifamily properties that are free and clear. So he did that. And about 2 weeks later, he called me. He says, I think I have one. Now, my criteria is very conservative. A lot of people in my market tell me that there's no way you can buy property at that price. It just doesn't make sense. There's no way. People won't do that, which I hate when people have preconceived notions because they miss a lot of opportunity. But long story short, the seller, I think, was asking $300,000 for this four-unit building in a nice area of Tampa over a place called Seminole Heights. And this building was the only one that was really the problem. Everything else around it is really nice. It's got all the houses, got the manicured lawns, and they're all painted real nice and pretty, and everybody's cars are brand new and all that. And then there's this building. It's the eyesore of the community. So this was a classic thing. The kid asked if I would help him negotiate the deal. And I said, well, for that to happen, I'm going to wind up being the buyer. So I'll do that. The three of us will get on the phone. We'll have a conversation. So I got on the phone with him, and I did have another student that I was coaching at the time on the phone who was looking for a deal. We hadn't found anything. They hadn't found anything on their own. So before the call, we had said, listen, you know, bring the capital into the deal. We'll split the deal down the middle. In this case, based on their needs, my student's needs, they needed tax benefits from this thing. Although they weren't much, they needed everything they could do, and I don't need the tax benefits right now. So what we did is I said, listen, you bring the down payment, and we'll go pull the trigger and make this deal happen. We get on the phone with the seller, and he's, like I said, he's priced it like $300,000. And I kid you not, Dan, we didn't really say much on our end at all. This is one of these guys that just never stops talking. I think
the seller, you mean?
Oh, yeah. He went on for a good 30, 40 minutes. And it was basically the average, yep, oh yeah, I totally agree, oh yeah.
Nice.
Telling us how amazing he is, how experienced he is. He grew up in Chicago, he's a retired firefighter, blah, 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 all this. So as we listened, he just started talking himself down. It's right. I mean, we were at right around 300K. I don't remember the exact asking price because it was off market, but it was around 300K. By the time he got done talking, I believe he got to 215. And he said, I won't take a penny less than 215. I said, the problem is the numbers don't stack up at 215. He says, well, then at 210, I'm done. I said, well, at 210, I'm done too. We can do it for 210. And that was it. It was probably the easiest negotiation I've ever had to do. I didn't have to say a word. I just had to shut up. That's all I had to do.
Nice.
So we go from 300,000 all the way down to 210. We've got four units, each renting at $700 a door currently. We're going to be raising the rents on those. We're doing some renovation work. We're probably going to put around 45,000 into it in renovations over four units, about 10K a door, kitchens and baths and that type of thing. Over the next year, we're going to do a phased build out. I've got some other properties that we're going to give up tenants the opportunity to relocate to newer properties so we can get in and rehab this one. But the goal is to get the rents, get it producing a gross of 4,000 a month. And like I said, we're in it for 210. The other thing that was the seller was complaining that in the city of Tampa, the water bills were just ridiculously high in this neighborhood, which I found odd. I just listened and I said, and I asked some more questions. I said, what do you mean about what are you talking about? He says, well, the water bill is $1,600 a month. And I'm thinking,
God.
I'm sorry, did I hear you? You said 1,600? He says, yeah. It's a four-unit building, right? Says, yeah. Huh. I've got other four-unit buildings in the area. I'm thinking to myself, I didn't say this out loud, that I'm paying like $120 a month all in. So I looked into it a little bit, and his meter readings were correct. And what we found out is the building was built in 1982 and had the same toilet and the same toilet plumbing in the unit since it was built. So the toilets were leaking by. $1,600 a month in water. It was nuts.
Wow.
I didn't really know a toilet could leak that much, to be honest with you.
How about that?
Yeah. So it worked out that we bought the building knowing that we could fix the problem. I mean, how much is a corky toilet flapper? Like $6. So we bought the building, had our handyman go and replace the toilet guts, and off we go. And we just got the water bill. I think it was $156 last month. So
nice.
Huge value add. It went from a negative equity situation. You know, we would have been upside down, but we know we can solve that problem. That's a problem that you know you can solve. I mean, because that just doesn't make sense. $1,600 for a water bill is nuts.
Outrageous.
So for us, it turned into a home run. You know, at the end of the day, we're going to have 4,000 gross coming in. We got 5% money on the deal, and it's a long-term hold scenario for us. We're not doing the value add and then flip it later type thing for us. We're just hanging on to them because we enjoy the passive income.
Cool. So 5% money, are you talking 25, 30% down and then went to the local bank there for the original mortgage, or did the other partner bring all of the $215,000 into the deal?
We used a local bank. We used a lender here in Tampa that for all of the properties that I've done here in this area that are bankable, we use him, and 30% down, 5% money, 30% came from the partner on the deal. So I didn't have to put any of my own cash into it. Of course, I'm the one that has the experience and the team to get this thing situated. So at the end of the day, it was a win-win for everybody. You know, my partner in the deal gets to walk through the process. Gets to walk through the restabilization, solving the problems. Obviously, the value of the building goes up exponentially. As the rents increase, it's in an amazing B+, almost an A- neighborhood. So even as it sat, it appraised for $25,000 more than what we had under contract for as it sat before improvement. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think it was a home run deal. Everybody wins.
Nice. And then the $45,000 in renovation money, I'm assuming that the partner will also bring that into the deal?
We're going to give them the option. And, you know, I've got a lot of people that – having a show, a podcast, I'm sure you realize a lot of people that want to invest with us. And I look at raising capital as I'm helping people leverage their retirement funds where otherwise that money would be sitting there. So I've got some other people that have been on the list for a while wanting to invest in some of our projects. So what I told the deal we made is, you know, let's talk to some other folks and see what type of thing we can work out with them. And you're already in this deal. And then we'll see if we can bring somebody in for the rehab, which we know we'll be able to. That way we can help everybody out. And then later,
when you say bring someone in, you know, 10% debt partner, or is it going to be chopping another piece of the equity into for the $45,000? I mean, how would that kind of go down?
Generally, standard debt agreement will give them, you know, anywhere between, depending on the what we're doing, between 4-7% return annually on their money in exchange for a lien position in the property, and we go that route.
Nice. So they'll be in second position on a mortgage note for $45,000 or something like that?
Correct.
Yeah, which isn't bad because it's pretty hard to park $45,000 anywhere and get solid returns, not a ton of cash where you can fund an entire deal. I mean, right. I guess with the exception of, you know, 30%, you know, this guy probably put the same 50, 60 grand into the deal and he's got certainly a nice position. So depending on where you come in, right?
That's exactly right. We've got some other assets. So, the benefit here is that we can structure every deal differently to meet the needs of the investor. And some people, sometimes they want a first lien position. Well, we have some free and clear assets. And in those cases, we can park a lien on one of those assets so they can have that first lien position they want. And every deal is different. I believe that I can't have a blanket way of doing things because everybody has different needs. Some guys, they're just investing to mitigate their tax liability. Some people need money every month. Some people don't want to see their money until they're retired. And it comes down to talking to them and figuring out, number one, why are you investing? Because it goes beyond because I want to make a return. I talk to doctors sometimes. I just recently had a doctor on the phone who was screaming bloody murder. He just did his taxes and he's been a hard money lender for the last 12 months. Well, all he's done is make his tax situation worse. And now he's mad at himself because he's created another taxable event because he didn't sit down with a tax professional and do some tax planning and figure out how better could he have invested his money. Because the return that he thought he made, you know, he said he made like, I think he got like 14%, which you would think on the surface is not bad, right? For hard money. The problem is, when you take the taxes off of that, what's left?
7 or 8.
So he got himself, you know, he wound up cutting his own throat. So, you know, we always try to get people to sit down with their tax professional. And I got to tell you, Dan, I'm shocked at how many people, even well-heeled, you would think financially savvy or well-paid individuals, they don't have a tax professional. They don't have a good person to guide them through that process. It's just sad.
That's definitely a topic we could probably harp on for a whole episode, I'm sure, the right type of tax person.
Right.
You know, because a big part of that, too, is it's not just the tax professional's job to dictate to, you know, your doctor friend, oh, here's how it's got to go and this and this and this. Because a lot of times the tax professional doesn't know what or is not responsible for what is the doctor's risk appetite. What opportunities are coming across the doctor's desk? This doctor, I'm sure, makes a fantastic living doing the profession that he's doing. I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to the show right now who are making great money doing what they're doing. And, you know, they're exploring real estate as an investment opportunity. And you hear hard money and you hear 14%. Then you hear invest in rental property, whether that's multifamily or single family, because you get depreciation and you can write some expenses off. And so, you know, I'm sure there's people who would have more along the lines of securities opportunities, whether that's IPOs in San Francisco and the tech scene, you know, someone in, right, in that field would have a different opportunity. So it's hard to basically put all that responsibility onto the tax professional. I think that you could get in a lot of trouble by thinking of the tax professional as kind of like a doctor prescribing a pill as the solution or saying, yeah, you need to buy rental property. You need to go out and buy a Cadillac Escalade so you can write it all off this year. You need to go out and, you know, because then they run out and they get in trouble and they buy the 4-unit building that you just talked about instead of at 215 that, you know, the tax professional tells them, go ahead out and buy some rental property. They buy it at $425,000 at the height of the market and it turns out to be a bad move. So, you know, for the benefit of anyone listening, it is up to you to be responsible for your financial health and you to figure out what are the questions you need to bring to your tax professional. And, you know, you want to kind of take point and lead the conversation with the tax professional and start to formulate and understand your own ideas when it comes to what options might be available. And, you know, to your point, sitting down with the tax professional ahead of time before you go make the hard money loan, and then 12 months later, you created this event that came with the sting of the taxable event attached at the end. So, yeah, great point, Tyler.
I just wanted to add, you know, self-education, folks, you don't have to take a program. I mean, there are books on this topic that are written by people like that are notable in the space, Tom Wheelwright, all these different authors that put out this these different things. I mean, the information is out there. We live in a society where information is everywhere. We're surrounded by it, but you got to take the time to self-educate.
Agreed. And you're listening to the show right now, and so you are obviously into self-education. That can be some of the challenge too, Tyler. I know for me, it's, you know, there's only so much time in a person's life. You have 24 hours a day, and it's like, I feel so blessed and so lucky. I feel like it was the wisdom or the blessing of God that I was able to have just the right books coming into my hands at just the right time over the past 6 or 7 years that I've personally experienced outstanding growth and results in my life. And I feel like if it weren't the right books and the right podcast episodes that I checked out, you know, I had gotten maybe like the wrong information or misinformation, because there's plenty of that out there too. I hate to think of where I would have been. So, you know, not only is it just getting your hands on the information, but, you know, this is where education and mentors and people who've gotten to where you want to go is so important, because they can tell you the right books. They can, you know, refer a specific podcast episode. I mean, I think you're up to what, like something like 80 shows on your podcast, Tyler. Is that right?
I am. That's correct.
I think I'm like right around that same number now. And it's like, you know, I could hand select the right guest, the right interview for somebody that, you know, I would personally mentor in my own businesses or life. And I do that with my partners so that they don't have to spend 82 hours going through all the episodes and like wondering which piece of information is important. If it happens to be an episode on, you know, multifamily investing and selecting Tampa Bay over Memphis, Tennessee, and a few of the reasons why, I would share this episode that we're creating right now in the moment. So, you know, the mentor can certainly help guide you in where to invest your time in getting the right education. It doesn't have to be a paid mentor. It can be somebody that you kind of find who went there. I could speak for a long time on my hunger for wisdom and knowledge and what that has resulted in my own life, but I think I'll digress for now. So, Tyler, you had mentioned that you have very conservative buying criteria. Let's do a fictitious deal right now. I just kind of want to get an example of your buying appetite. We find a 20-unit property that's relatively stable with rents that are maybe a $50 or $100, you know, below market right now, completely full in the Tampa Bay, Florida area. Would you do this based on comps, or would a cap rate type of analyzation, you know, be the way that you define and look at the deal? So would you be looking at like a price per door, or would it be more of like a cap rate? And if so, like what would be kind of ideal for what you're seeing out there that you'd like to buy?
The first thing I do is I use a hurdle rate, which basically it's similar to a cap rate. It illustrates the ratio between the gross income, monthly income that an asset can generate, and what its purchase price should be. So what I'll do is I'll take the gross monthly rents. So let's say that in this case, let's say we've got them at $750 a door right now, rents. I'll take that $750 a door. I'll multiply it by the number of doors. You said 20, so 750 times 20. That's going to give me $15,000 a month in income coming in, a gross number. That's before any expenses come out, all that. I'm going to take that $15,000. I'm going to divide that by 1.5%. That's going to give me $666,000, basically a bunch of sixes, 66666. That's kind of scary. That moment, turn away from this building. It's like, oh boy, I'm not superstitious, but that's a little
creepy. Yeah, but that one.
But I use the hurdle rate is nothing more than a quick test. It tells me about where I need to be for a strike price in all in. And that includes my rehab, my closing costs. If I've got assignment fees to, you know, there was another investor in the mix, I had to compensate, repairs, things like this. I would need to be somewhere around 666 or 666,000. For that to make sense based on my criteria. And that's usually the point where I lose most people, where most people go, you're crazy. You can't do that. That'll never work. Well, remember, it's a quick test. Okay. It's not the end all be all, but it's what I've been using now for several years. And I'm telling you, it works. Number one, it forces me to negotiate a better deal, because I have in my head that I need to be around that number for that deal to make sense. Because let's be honest, when was the last time you ever got any data from a seller? First time go, that was 100% accurate.
Been yeah, I don't think they were able years. To keep it. Yep.
No, 17 years, I've never seen anything come over 100% accurate. I don't think it's possible. So, you know, based on that, this allows for that margin of error. And this is just the initial, let's see if we can be in the ballpark type conversation. Because I know in this case, if you're in my market, that 20-unit building would probably be priced probably listed by a residential agent because it's too small for a commercial agent, first of all, mistake number one. And then it's they're going to pull comps, which always makes my head shudder, and they're going to look at, oh, gee, the other, that 24-unit building sold for this, and they make these calculations up in their head. There's no rhyme or reason to them. And that somehow that equates to, that'll be $3 million. Well, here's the problem, folks. You know, the banks aren't going to agree with you on that ever. If your investors have any brains, they're going to do a little due diligence before they help you fund this deal. The dog just doesn't hunt. So let's not waste each other's time. Let's get down to what will work, you know, because the investors and the banks are only going to allow us to do so much. So we need to get
that
there.
Puts us at like $33,000 a door, right, on this one?
Correct.
So have you gotten some handful of deals done at that, you know, $750 a month based on a price per door month? Can you give me an idea of like maybe one that you had to go outside that range and maybe some reasons why you felt okay because of the neighborhood or the, you know, upside or what have you in the rents that would justify going higher?
Sure, let's go back to that fourplex. We've got 4 units at $700 a month, right? So we got $2,800 divided by 1.5%. My strike price should have been $186. I paid $210. Let's do the same math again. When we get, I know that $1,000 a month is actually conservative in that neighborhood for rent. Let's go with 1,000 just to be conservative, times 4, divide that by 1.5%. That puts me up to 266.66. So I know based on this quick math only, and I know there's a lot of engineers that are listening to the show are going, but that's not exact. I get it. I totally get it. It's a quick test. That's all it is. It's really no more accurate than cap rate, so to speak. It's just not falsely influenced by, you know, by leaving
submitting
information. Right. So based on that, I know that I'm in good shape. I can look at that and go, yeah, I'm close enough. I'm in the ballpark. Because we both know when I reduce that water bill, that alone, look at the found equity right there.
Yeah, I just did the quick math now. I came up with what, 266.66, you know, repeating, which by the time you put your 45 grand in there, you're almost to the penny, right, where you actually needed to be, right?
Exactly. Yep.
Based on the new rents of $1,000.
Correct. Now, dig into the, get an appraiser out there that's going to use the gross rent multiplier. They're going to do a income analysis on their appraisal. That thing's probably going to appraise somewhere in the neighborhood of around 400 in this market right now. And now we're going to be able to do a refi. So let's say it's worth 400 and we're just throwing numbers out. It's not actual numbers, but 400,000. So 70%, we're going to be, if they 70% loan to value, they're going to be able to loan us 280,000. How much do we have in this deal? A lot less than that.
Do you ever adjust that 1.5% to 1.4 or 1.6 or 1.7 or 1.3 for any reason?
No, I will not. I know me. And if I start to adjust, it's kind of like when you put money, when you're a kid and you put money in your piggy bank and you're always looking for a way to get that nickel out of the penny piggy bank.
Mm-hmm.
I am that fat kid. I'm telling you, I was that kid that would sit there with a nail file and a magnet trying to figure out a way to get money out of the piggy bank because I wouldn't want to crack it. But if I could, there's a way I could a little tweak and no, I don't deviate. If it doesn't fall within my pricing parameters, within my criteria, I don't buy it. That's simple.
Nice.
That forces me though, Dan. That forces me to be a good negotiator. I had to force myself to learn how to effectively negotiate. So I made it harder on myself. But we don't lose money on our deals anymore. You see, that's the big difference. Everybody else is writing checks to their investments. We're cashing them.
Sounds like a plan to me. Tyler, is there anything that you have implemented, an idea, a system, a strategy, maybe in the last 1 or 2 years that has created exponential growth or certainly outstanding results for your company and your businesses?
I'd say bar none, number one is my podcast. Starting a podcast, and more importantly, like we're doing right now, being genuine. You know, there's so much fluff out there with a lot of the shows and a lot of the marketing you see out there. So we're right to the point. You know, if I think it's ridiculous, I'm going to tell you it's ridiculous, flat out. Is we've changed our business model to the fact that we're focused on, we have a good time, and we're fiercely ethical. In other words, doing good business is more important than doing a lot of business to us. And that's been huge. And that's been the overtone of my podcast is to help people realize that nothing that we do here is rocket science. And you can build wealth in real estate the same way they've been doing it for the last 50 years.
I can agree with you wholeheartedly. I do my podcast. We don't do any paid coaching, seminars, nothing of that nature at all. I mean, we do this and, you know, we have people who reach out to our show and they bring us deals all the time and you know, we buy some of them. Some of them just don't fit our criteria. We let them know that quickly as well. You know, I have business partners now who are operating around the country that I had met solely through, they found me on the podcast. So I can wholeheartedly agree with you and love doing it. Love giving back, you know, just kind of sharing the knowledge, the insights, the information, great guests like yourself, Tyler. So yeah, well said. Tyler, if you could name, well, you may not have to name them, but you can answer this question as you see fit. Who is the most successful real estate investor or developer, and why do you believe they're successful?
I think the who, I'm going to have to say Ken McElroy. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, I've met Ken a couple of times. I've got an opportunity to look at his business model, how he does things. You know, he's got thousands and thousands of doors. When he decides he wants to raise capital for a deal, it takes, he can raise $10 million in 45 minutes. Where the rest of us, it at least takes us a couple of days. And I don't know about you, but I'm not doing $10 million deals. But it's impressive to the degree of his reach, you know, how big his database is. And every time he does a deal, he always exceeds the expectations of the investors. In other words, if you think you're getting 110 grand back, you're probably going to get 120, because that's just how Kenny does business. And I like that. I think that's cool.
Are there two or three books you've recommended most often?
No, I got to say, if I had to come up with three, which is tough because I come up with about 40, but my three, definitely number one would be The One Thing. I got the opportunity to interview the author, Jay Papasan. It was a co-written with Jay Papasan and Gary Keller. Gary Keller is the founder of Keller Williams Real Estate. It was an unbelievable episode. It's one of those episodes where you hang up with the after the recording stops and you're on the phone with the guest for another 2 hours. Probably the best episode I've ever done, ever. Just an amazing guy. I mean, most helpful pub thing ever put into print, in my opinion. That book changed my life because I am a guy that can be very easily distracted, especially in today's society. So The One Thing by Jay Papasan. They've got a whole website now and all kinds of free stuff. So it's awesome. Second one, I'm going to have to go with How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And a lot of this comes down to going back to The One Thing. We as a society have forgotten how to work with each other. You know, there was a time if you and I had an issue, we'd get on the phone or we'd go meet for a cup of coffee and work it out. And now in today's society, we protest or we go say derogatory things about one another in a public space and embarrass each other and insult each other. And that's unfortunate. I think that The One Thing, or the How to Win Friends and Influence People, it really gets you down to the core values of first understanding that, you know, what we do because it's good for us. Let's be realistic. Mother Teresa is Mother Teresa because it makes her feel good to be Mother Teresa. I mean, the fact that she's helping people is a byproduct of that. But at her core, she likes to feel good about what she's doing. You and I are doing this podcast because we wanted to grow our audience and we want to have a larger reach so we can do more business and we care about people. You know, there's many, many reasons why things happen. And basically that book says to me that it's okay to come to terms with these things. It's okay to maybe put selfish isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's okay to focus inward first, get yourself right, and then focus on the needs of other people. And I guess third one, I'm going to have to say in this one, other one, today's society, this rings true. And people, I think, have forgotten about the book because I haven't heard a lot of people mention it lately, but it's Who Moved My Cheese, which is probably one of the shortest books you'll ever read. It's about, I don't know, 30 pages, something like that. Written by Spencer Johnson, I think is the author's name. Spencer Johnson, yeah. Who Moved My Cheese? Great little book, and it talks about dealing with change. And, you know, we live in a society where things are changing every day, every minute, you know, every second. I don't know if you ever tried advertising on Facebook, but they changed their they changed their rules, it seems, by the hour. So we're a constantly evolving world, and I think that book will help keep you sane if you haven't read it already.
Yeah, that was a good one. I remember I read that in like 2009 or 2010, so I was kind of just about bankrupted and broke from the change in the real estate market and my inability to adapt. And I kept trying the same thing and just was too young and blissfully ignorant of the fact that the cheese was moved. The opportunity was moved. The opportunity was in a different place than where I had found the opportunity when the market was, you know, red hot and buyers were everywhere and the prices were up and everybody had equity to cash in and sell. And what an eye-opening explanation of the reality that I was in at the moment. I can certainly agree with you on that. Tyler, if you could go back and share with your younger self, 18 years old, the crown jewel of wisdom, what would that be?
Well, I think that conversation would have to start with my boot on my 18-year-old self's neck, because back then I thought I knew everything, and I'm not sure that I would have listened to any of my own advice back then. So I'd have to start there. But the first I guess the biggest piece of advice would have to be to buy every piece of real estate that I can buy that will generate positive cash flow. Every piece of real estate that will generate positive cash flow. Every single one. If I think about, I'm not one of those people that lives in the rearview mirror. I'm more of a forward thinker, but I would hate to think how many opportunities I may have passed up, just not even thinking it was too much work or I couldn't do it. I should have. Now I have a nephew that's 18, and he's getting ready to start buying his first piece, couple pieces of property. So I'm looking forward to that.
If anybody, Tyler, is listening, wants to get some more information about you, check out your podcast, you know, join some of your mailing lists, things of that nature. Is there some contact information you'd like to share with the guests?
Yeah, everything that I do lives in one place. It's on the Cash Flow Guys website. And that's cashflowguys.com, cashflowguys.com. You can see my podcast there. I do instructional videos, how to write contracts, how to negotiate, all this other stuff that involves real estate and mindset. I've got a whole series on video. I do a weekly TV show. And Fridays, we just took a brief pause. We're moving studios. We're going to be up and running again here next week. So that's a regular thing. It's all on my website. It's all housed right there, our book club. Head on over there. Check us out.
Cool. Sounds good. I have a couple pages of notes here, Tyler. You would think, you know, me after being in the business would just be able to kind of do these on the fly, but I love getting people like yourself and hearing the experience. I got to say, the one you gave me personally, two big takeaways here. The one I really enjoyed was, you know, the Memphis, Tennessee insights into seeing a market that's, you know, marketed by the market itself to outside investors as being an easy, you know, an easy going place to do business. And then, you know, getting that same perception from all of the service providers, et cetera, that are going to handle the investment, and then finding out that, you know, it was a little bit more challenging and there were some other risks under the surface. So I think that was really important as, you know, me personally, as I look at other markets around the country, and I'm sure a lot of other people who are listening would take away that one as well. And the other one I think was really powerful for me, I've looked at many, many, many multifamily deals over my career in real estate, have not pulled the trigger on any, did not quickly have access to something like using the 1.5% hurdle rate, which I've written down. I'm like, man, this just would have saved so much time. It just takes the blinders off. It removes the clouds and you can see clearly, at least if you're in the ballpark of a makeable deal or not right from the gate. And I thank you for those insights and I thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to be here with us on the REI Diamond Show, Tyler. Thank you.
The pleasure is all mine. I really appreciate, number one, you taking the time out to have me on the show, but more importantly, that your listeners taking the time out of their day. And I know they're all busy. They're driving down the road. They're going to work every day. They're doing their thing. Taking the time to listen to you and I talk about that is that what we love. So thank you very much.
And thank you, my loyal listener, for checking out this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving a notification when I release the next episode? You can sign up at www.reidiamonds.com, and I will send you a copy of my free book by PDF version, How to Become a Wholesale Real Estate Master, which is basically the business plan I use to wholesale about 45 to 50 deals every month throughout the country. Or you can also subscribe through one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you are interested in selling a deal to me, I am currently buying single-family houses, small apartment buildings, usually duplex, triplex, four units, and we'll check out some other larger units and some commercial property. You can go to www.reidiamonds.com and click the link at the top of the page. I am currently buying deals in the Philadelphia tri-state area, the Baltimore, Maryland, D.C. market, the Chicagoland region, the Atlanta region, and the Tampa Bay area in Florida. Finally, do you know anyone else who might also enjoy this episode? I would appreciate the referral, and I am sure that the recipient would also enjoy the episode as well and appreciate the referral too. Last but not least, I appreciate you, my loyal listener of the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.